This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
When ISIS attacked a concert hall in Moscow last weekend, it left at least 137 people dead, hundreds more injured, and the world wondering why it happened, and what, if anything, does it have to do with the war in Ukraine?
The information space is being dominated by claims of Ukrainian involvement, claims Kyiv denies.
On today's podcast, terrorism expert Colin P. Clark explains that while we in Europe may have thought ISIS was a thing of the past, in reality, the jihadist terrorists have not gone away.
We look at this globally, this is a group that, while it's been defeated in some parts of the West, it's certainly surged in other parts of the world.
This is In the News from the Irish Times. I'm Bernice Harrison. Today, terror in Moscow. Is ISIS back? And what does the attack mean for the war in Ukraine? Colin P. Clark is a senior research fellow at the Soufan Centre and is the author of After the Caliphate, The Islamic State and the Future Terrorist Diaspora. Colin, you watched the video of the attack. Can you describe how it unfolded and whether the attackers followed a typical ISIS playbook?
Yeah, so in some ways they did, right? Even down to target selection. This was a soft target that was likely to generate, you know, a lot of media attention. I would call this a spectacular attack in that there was multiple attackers. You know, these weren't the best trained militants in the world, but there was some element of training there. And so, you know, the body count speaks for itself. The fact that they burned the building, right? That image of this kind of burning concert hall is now, you know, on every cover of every newspaper around the world. So they're doing, you know, what they intended to do, which is, look, let's not forget, at the end of the day, a big component of terrorism is psychological, right? And so they want to leave that imprint in the minds of people and scare people. They do want to, as the word suggests, terrorize. You know, I've had some people ask me, well, could it really be an ISIS attack if they didn't have suicide vests, if they didn't blow themselves up? Not every ISIS attack is a suicide attack. These are individuals who may have been planning to do a follow-up attack. There could be reasons why they didn't have suicide vests. For example, they might not have sought out those type of explosives so as to stay under the radar. They might have perceived that as vulnerable, right? That could have tipped off the security forces to their plot. So again, the difficulty here is that it happened in Russia, and so we're never going to get the true story from the Russian government. And that's especially true because, as has been, you know, made public, the United States warned the Russians about this attack and they whiffed on it. So there's a level of embarrassment from the Russian government, and they should be embarrassed for being unable to keep their citizens safe. They're off waging wars in other countries when they should be focused on internal security. Meanwhile, you know, they're persecuting Alexei Navalny supporters and people that, you know, said bad things about Vladimir Putin during the recent sham election. So the Russians have a lot of their own issues. If ISIS-K continues to target Russia, which I think they will, the Russians certainly have their hands full.
Russia has accepted, I mean, albeit reluctantly, the culpability of ISIS in the Moscow attack. But in the aftermath of the attack, Putin cast some doubt on the involvement of ISIS. He essentially said, why would ISIS attack us? They have no reason to, perhaps alluding to Russian support for a ceasefire in Gaza. Can you explain why Russia is seen as a target by ISIS?
Yeah, Vladimir Putin's killed a lot of Muslims. it's that simple. You know, it may be distant in his memory, but one need to look no further than Syria for an example of that. Moreover, if you look at ISIS's hit list, the one group they hate more than the Americans, the Israelis, and others is Shia. And Vladimir Putin is looked at as the vanguard of defending Shia Islam. He's propped up Bashar al-Assad in Syria. He works hand in glove with the Iranians. The Wagner group, the Russian mercenary groups, operated side by side with Hezbollah. So, you know, there's a long list. We can go back to Chechnya, and the jihadis have a long memory. They even talk about, you know, Soviet involvement in Afghanistan from 1979 to 1989. So, of course, Putin denied it, and Iran did the same thing in the aftermath of the Kerman bombing at Qasem Soleimani Shrine in early January. They blamed the Israelis. They ultimately had to walk that back and admit that it was jihadist terrorists. So, you know, these regimes should focus more on protecting their own people than trying to blame, you know, the boogeyman for their own shortcomings.
The Moscow attack was carried out by an ISIS splinter group called ISIS-K. Who are they?
Well, the Islamic State Khorasan, I wouldn't necessarily call them a splinter group. They're more of a province under this broader global network of Islamic State affiliates. A splinter group would mean that they kind of broke off and are doing their own thing. Here, this is, you know, a group that works hand in glove with the other affiliates as again, part of a kind of global network. They're based in Afghanistan, but have a lot of Central Asian militants, particularly in the group's leadership. And I'd say, you know, I've made the comparison between ISIS-K or the group I like to call Islamic State Khorasan Province, ISKP, and Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in the mid to late 2010s, when that group kind of eclipsed Al-Qaeda core as the most operationally capable of all the kind of franchise groups.
What does ISIS-K want?
At the end of the day, ISIS-K wants what every ISIS province wants, and which is what the core organization wants, which is to establish a caliphate, right? That's what they were building in Raqqa and Mosul during their state building project, which began in earnest in 2014. You know, the caliphate 5 years ago, actually this month, lost its last piece of physical territory around Baghouz, Syria. We've still got, you know, tens of thousands of ISIS members. I say that broadly. That means ISIS fighters who are in detention camps, and then their families, women and children, who are in kind of refugee camps in northeastern Syria, places like Al-Hol, which are really in deplorable condition. So in many ways, you know, while the core has been attenuated, other ISIS affiliates elsewhere in the world are on the march. And so it's an extremely complex organization. These groups ebb and flow over time. Groups in Libya, Yemen, Somalia, and Southeast Asia right now are probably at a low point. But you know, geopolitical factors and different conditions can lead those things to change.
Dragged into court, bloodied and bowed, the men Russia accuses of carrying out the terrorist attack on Friday on the outskirts of Moscow, leaving 137 dead. All of them showed signs of having been beaten.
One of them, Colin, the men who carried out the attack, four of whom have been detained and apparently tortured in Russia, are believed to be from Tajikistan. That's the Central Asian country that was part of the Soviet Union. Its population is over 90% Muslim. Many Tajiks live in Moscow, where they are reportedly treated really poorly and experience racism. Should this terror attack be seen in that light?
You're right about the radicalizing factors of many Tajik migrants in Russia. The key is going to be finding out, you know, were these individuals who live there and were merely inspired by the Islamic State, or were they actually trained? Was this a kind of directed attack? And my money would be on the latter, just because the level of training seems to be there. If you watch the video of how the attack unfolded. Now, you know, certainly they made some mistakes, and there's plenty to point out there. But if you look at the body count and the fact that they were able to keep this attack under the noses of the Russian security services, it points to some kind of operational security or OPSEC. And that's something that would come with training from a terrorist group like ISIS-K.
Now, after the US withdrew from Afghanistan in 2021 and the Taliban took control, US President Joe Biden, he said that Afghanistan would never again become a terrorist safe haven. But that's not what happened.
No, and at the time, many counterterrorism experts, myself included, said as much. You know, this was part of it was a byproduct of the Doha deal between the US and the Taliban, which I'll point out was carried through across Republican and Democrat administrations. It's one of the few areas of bipartisan agreement was withdrawing the U.S. from Afghanistan. And as part of the Doha deal, the Taliban was supposed to prevent the country from ever becoming a launching pad for international terrorism. Now, there's two aspects to that. There's the intent or the will, and there's the capability. I think the Taliban, you know, certainly as an adversary of ISK, is attempting to counter the group. They just don't have the capability, right? And so they can't govern the entire country. Look, the U.S. military was in the country for 20-something years and was unable to defeat some of the terrorist groups based there. So how could we expect the Taliban to do that with far less manpower, fewer tools? You know, it's just not something that's going to happen. So again, as predicted by most people watching this closely, the country is once again devolved into a safe haven and a sanctuary for transnational jihadist groups.
How active has ISIS-K been before the Moscow attack? You know, the wider world is hearing a lot about ISIS-K in the last week. But how active has it been and where has it been active?
So just this year alone in 2024, the Islamic State Khorasan has launched attacks in Iran, in Turkey, and has had several plots disrupted in Europe, in Western Europe. In Germany, a plot targeting Sweden. Just the other day, for the first time that I've heard publicly, French President Emmanuel Macron claimed that ISIS-K had been plotting on French soil, and we know that the French have the Paris 2024 Summer Olympics coming up. And then even going back to, you know, the past couple of years, there's been numerous ISIS-K plots. We learned that from the Discord leaks. There was even a plot targeting the World Cup. So many of these have been disrupted, but it does show you that this is a group that's persistent, that their operational tempo is increasing in frequency. And the Moscow attack shows just how dangerous that is.
Before we started chatting, I was thinking about 2017. And in the UK alone, there was the Westminster attack, the Manchester Arena bombing, and the London Bridge attack. And obviously, in that year, there were events in Belgium and Germany and Russia, Spain. But I think most people would feel that it's been mercifully quiet since then. And, you know, it's felt free from the dread of an ISIS attack. Is that set to change?
Well, I'd say that your description is accurate if you're living in Western Europe. If you're living in anywhere in Africa, that's probably not true. So while the attacks in Africa don't get the same media coverage as they would in Paris, you know, the Islamic State has continued to kill large numbers of civilians. So I think that, you know, that's one thing to keep in mind is, you know, I remember that what I would call the apex of the Islamic State quite well. And you're right, it seemed like almost every week there was something else happening, particularly when we had the rash of vehicle attacks, Nice, Berlin, Stockholm, elsewhere. And, you know, if there was a stabbing and a policeman was stabbed in France, I would be asked to come on CNN and talk about it. But at the same time, if Boko Haram blew up a market and killed, you know, 80 people in Nigeria, it was on page A17 of the New York Times. So I think, you know, we have to be careful about the way we talk about terrorism, because, again, we look at this globally. This is a group that, while it's been defeated in some parts of the West, it's certainly surged in other parts of the world.
Now, you explained before that ISIS-K, it's not a splinter group. It's an affiliate of ISIS. But I suppose, you know, what does that mean? Is it a large group? What do we know about its size and strength?
Yeah, so it's definitely the most potent and the most aggressive of all of the IS affiliates. There's also a number of groups in sub-Saharan Africa, groups like the Islamic State West Africa Province or the Islamic State Sahel Province. And so they, you know, control large portions of territory all the way from kind of littoral West Africa over to the Lake Chad Basin. But ISIS-K in Afghanistan is believed to be you know, several thousand fighters, and again, kind of pulled from throughout Afghanistan, but also the broader region, including fighters from Pakistan. And again, this is a group that's really kind of spread its network, spread its tentacles outside of the country. And now, with this increasing operational tempo of plots and now attacks, there's major concern. We saw France and Italy both raising their terror threat alert level this week, and other countries may soon do the same.
The biggest global event this year will be the Paris Olympics. After Moscow, Is there a real fear that it could become a target?
I think it was a target even before Moscow, but that just kind of further highlights the sense of urgency there. And I think, you know, the French have their hands full. France has been a country that's been targeted, you know, probably more than most other in the others in the West over time. Large number of leading jihadis are French. So, and there's individuals that are now coming out of prison, right, that have served time for terrorist attacks, and that stretches the bandwidth of the security services who now have to kind of monitor them. I'm very concerned about some kind of plot on the Paris Olympics. I do have confidence in the French security forces. I think, you know, they're among the best in the world, and they're going to be prepared. But this is a cat and mouse game, and, you know, there certainly will be no shortage of attention kind of watching how things go. And, you know, I can only hope and pray that things go smoothly.
Vladimir Putin suggested that the attackers were being aided by Ukraine. Is there any evidence at all of cooperation between ISIS and Ukraine?
In a word, no.
Coming up, Ukraine is dragged into the terrorist atrocity. But will it impact the war? I talked to reporter Dan McLaughlin after this short break.
This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, creating a more friction-free office. Made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
Dan McLaughlin reports from Ukraine for the Irish Times. Dan, before the attack, the US warned its citizens in Moscow that the risk of such an attack was high. Putin denied this, and he said it was Western propaganda, so he was wrong. Then, after the attack, he gave a speech where he didn't mention ISIS by name, even though his government accepts ISIS were behind the atrocity. But in that speech, he did say that Ukraine was helping the attackers. Why did Putin do that? And how has Ukraine responded to those allegations?
Well, there was an immediate fear here in Ukraine as soon as people saw this happening, unfolding in Moscow last Friday night, that in some way Putin would blame Ukraine for this, because the whole narrative of Putin's regime over the last 2 years and for longer has been that this existential threat, as Putin puts it, is being posed to Russia by Ukraine and by its Western backers. So there was an immediate fear that somehow he would try and pin this on Ukraine. And so it turned out, even though he's presented absolutely no evidence for this, he came out the day after the attack and said that these attackers were making for Ukraine. He claimed that, as he put it, a window had been opened for them on the border for them to cross into Ukraine and get away. So the suggestion being that there were accomplices in Ukraine waiting to bring them across the border. Other Russian officials have since come out and said, claimed things like they were going to be welcomed in Ukraine, they were going to be welcomed as heroes, that this is all part of this grand Western plot, as the Russian regime puts it, to undermine and ultimately destroy Russia. In fact, we heard from Maria Zakharova. She's the Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman today. And she was pushing this line, and she didn't present any evidence. All she did say was that the very fact that America came out quickly and said that Ukraine was not involved, that in itself is evidence of Ukraine's involvement. So there you can see how Russia is kind of scratching around, as it seems now, for anything that can truly pin this attack on Ukraine and its Western allies.
And how has Ukraine responded to the allegations?
Well, President Zelensky came out, and I think it's fair to say he seemed disgusted as he made this address to the nation.
Instead of dealing with his Russian citizens and addressing them, Putin was silent for the whole day, thinking about how to link the attack to Ukraine. It's completely predictable.
He called Putin a sick person, a cynical person, for instead of dealing with this security issue properly, instead of addressing his own people in Russia quickly and reassuring them and telling them that they were going to get to the bottom of this plot and this horrific attack that took place, he looked for a way to blame it on Ukraine. I can't say that people here are surprised by it. There's kind of a weary acceptance that Russia would try to use this in some way against Ukraine, and that's how it's playing out at the moment.
Nearly a week on, presumably this is a massive subject in Russian media. What's been said, and how is the narrative around the attack developing?
We haven't seen any major changes in this narrative so far. As we mentioned there, Putin came out quickly and said, without offering any evidence, that this window was opened for the attackers to escape into Ukraine. It's been undermined in various ways, though. I mean, just yesterday, for example, President Alexander Lukashenko of Belarus, he's probably Putin's closest ally, certainly in Europe. He came out and said, somewhat boastfully, I think, because he's very proud of his own security forces, he said that these attackers were actually heading for Belarus to try and get across the border. And it's only when they saw that the security was so tight in Belarus that they turned towards Ukraine. So immediately that kind of undermines Putin's argument, that Putin's claim that this was already prearranged, that there were accomplices waiting in Ukraine to smuggle these attackers across the border. So we're still waiting to see what the security services and what the authorities in Russia can put up in terms of evidence. Of course, there's a fear that at some point they will take one of the 11 people that they say they've arrested, including the four gunmen that they say they've arrested, and film some kind of confession which supposedly links Ukraine to this. We've seen these four people brought up in court, accused of carrying out the attack on the concert hall outside Moscow, and they look like they've been very badly beaten. One of them had bruises all over his face. Another one appeared to be unconscious in the courtroom. Another one was actually filmed having his ear cut off by the people who detained him, and it was forced into his mouth. So it looks like there are clear signs of beatings and maybe torture here, we could say. So it's certainly not beyond the realms of possibility that there could be a forced confession coming up, which will be televised and which will supposedly link the attackers to Ukraine. Can any of that really be believed when such a confession would be given under these circumstances? I don't think so.
Dan, you're in Ukraine. Are there fears there that the Moscow atrocity could ultimately be used as a pretext for an intensified war?
They don't really think that he even needs a pretext to escalate. So they're just expecting more. Putin may well use this and try to tie Ukraine and its Western allies up into some kind of conspiracy theory about them being supporters of global terrorism. We're already hearing that from quite senior officials in the Russian administration. But Ukrainians really just expect more of the same, whatever the rhetoric is coming from the Kremlin.
Thanks very much, Dan. That's it for today. For more international coverage, subscribe at irishtimes.com/subscribe. I'm Bernice Harrison. This episode was produced by Declan Conlon. In the news, we'll be back tomorrow.